The White House email controversy is back. This time, though, it involves key members of the Trump team.
According to a report from Politico, the White House is looking into the use of private email accounts for government business by senior Trump officials. The probe comes after another report said the president's senior advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, used private email for official business.
Email practices in the Trump White House are under extra scrutiny, given that Trump was extremely critical of his former opponent, Hillary Clinton's private email server. Here's a little bit of the second Trump-Clinton debate.
The thing that you should be apologizing for are the 33,000 emails that you deleted and that you acid washed. And then the two boxes of emails and other things last week that were taken from an office and are now missing. And I'll tell you what, I didn't think I'd say this, but I'm going to say it, and I hate to say it, but if I win, I am going to instruct my attorney general to get a special prosecutor to look into your situation.
Andrea Peterson is an investigator for the Project on Government Oversight, a former Washington Post journalist. She helped break the story on the email probe. Andrea, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, I'm used to it. I was from there originally.
You're from the Central Time Zone.
Yeah, I'm Kansan originally.
Okay, so, same basic concept.
Yeah.
So Andrea, tell us, give us the basics here. What do we know about what private email accounts were used for in the White House?
So Jared Kushner's lawyer has said that there was only limited use and sporadic use. He says specifically that Kushner was involved in less than 100 exchanges that with other White House officials on this personal account, which we know is set up on a private web domain, ijkfamily.com, which I just can't say without thinking. It says, like, I'm just kidding, family. But that's neither here nor there. And we know, as I reported with Josh Dossie over at Politico, who broke the initial story about Kushner's private email use, that the White House has now launched an internal probe into the use of private email accounts by senior White House staff.
Now, the word email has a strong connotation in politics after the election campaign. Can you talk about what is different here about the use of email, as far as we know, of private email in the Trump White House, as opposed to what Hillary Clinton had been doing with her private email server?
Sure, and you know, it's easy to sort of think at first, oh, there are so many parallels here, but there are also very significant differences. The biggest being that Secretary Clinton was the head of a major agency. She set up a private email server, and she used it exclusively for her work business. She didn't have an actual email account that was on the state. Within the State Department, whereas in this particular circumstance, Kushner's lawyer says that he primarily uses his White House email account for official business, but just in a handful of cases, primarily, his lawyer says, when other people initially contacted him on this private account, he would respond, and Kushner's lawyer says that he would forward those communications to his official account to make sure that they were archived in line with what the Presidential Records Act mandates.
So is there any notion that what is being done here by Kushner and others, and we'll get into who all is doing this and being probed here, but is there anything, any idea that any of this is illegal as far as using these private email accounts?
You know, as far as we know, nothing seems to be illegal. As I just mentioned, his lawyer says that he was forwarding things up to his official account to make sure that they were archived in accordance with the law.
So who all is included, as far as we know, in this probe, who might have used private email accounts when they, I guess, preferably should not have?
So, I mean, there are a few different folks. One of them is, you know, Jared's wife and Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka. There have also been reports of other current and former officials, including, for instance, like Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon.
And what do we know about what kind of probe is being done by the White House here looking into this?
So, you know, it's We only have a few details at this point. We know it's being run by the general counsel and that it's involving in pulling batches of emails for review to see whether or not there was official business going to these other private accounts.
And how about Congress? I understand that some people in Congress are wanting more information about what happened on these emails.
Yeah, so the chair and ranking member of the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday reached out to Kushner's lawyer asking essentially why didn't we know about this private email account and requesting that they be told about any other email accounts that might have information related to the ongoing probe into Russian influence on the 2016 election.
Talking to Andrea Peterson, investigator for the Project on Government Oversight, a former Washington Post journalist. We're looking at news that the White House is doing an internal investigation into the use of private email by Trump aides.
And we'll pick up our conversation in a little bit, maybe hear from you. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Andrea Peterson. She's an investigator for the Project on Government Oversight. We're looking at a story she helped break about the White House looking into the private email use of senior Trump aides.
And you can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the investigation in the White House? Do you think that the Trump administration should be scrutinized for private email use? Does this make you look at the Clinton email investigation any differently? You can call in right now at 800-642-1234.
And Andrea, let's talk a little bit about the politics of this. Obviously, the Clinton email issue was a huge part of the political campaign, whether it swayed votes or not, who can say at this point. But do you think that this is going to be a political football now, the Trump email use? Again, though it is different than what Hillary Clinton had done with her email server.
Yeah, you know, even though there are differences, it is sort of hard to believe that during the transition, the Kushner family decided to set up an account in this particular way. It almost seems like hubris, but as we established, there are a lot of differences, at least about what their representatives have said about how they've used the email accounts.
Now, as you work in government oversight with the Project on Government Oversight, why is it important to the American people to know what email accounts top White House officials are using and what they're doing on them, what kind of business they're conducting?
Well, you know, it's, I think, incredibly important to make sure that senior or executives within the administration are complying with laws that mandate the archiving of that kind of material. And, you know, in this case, Kushner's lawyers have said that they are, in fact, doing that. And, you know, there's now an investigation going on inside the White House to track that down and make sure that's the case.
And then there's the cybersecurity issue. One of the big concerns with Hillary Clinton was that not only was she talking about government business, she was talking about potentially sensitive State Department issues, possible national security implications. With these, it doesn't look like there's any classified documents, but they're important information going on related to what the government is doing. Is it a concern that a private email account or server might not have the same level of protection that a government server might have?
You know, I think in speaking generally, you're always going to want to ask questions about what the security is of an account that's being used by its senior folks within the White House for official business. And in this case, we just don't have a lot of answers on that front.
Are government rules keeping up with changing technology, not just email, but newer, fancier stuff like the latest smartphones, the latest social media applications?
You know, another point that's been reported previously is that some officials within the administration were relying on encrypted messaging apps that can be set to automatically delete messages. And I think there are a lot of questions about how our current systems could catch things like that and make sure they're archived in compliance with the law.
And of course, President Trump, a big fan of using Twitter. He has recently hidden or deleted some of his posts, most recently about the Alabama Republican Senate primary there. And I understand there are lawsuits and court cases. Is that something we should be worried about, what officials are doing when it comes to maintaining Twitter statements and Facebook and Instagram and whatever the net, Snapchat for that matter?
You know, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to try and get too far into that one. But, I mean, certainly we're having a very robust public conversation about how that kind of information should be archived. And, you know, this is a conversation we've been having for administrations now. If you look back all the way to the George W. Bush administration, there was a significant controversy over some 20 million plus emails that ended up being deleted because they were run through a server that was hosted by the RNC. So this is a problem or a concern that's been around for quite some time, and we still haven't quite figured out how to handle it, as the conversations we're having now show.
Andrea, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Andrea Peterson, investigator for the Project on Government Oversight. She joined us to look at a report she helped break on an internal probe in the White House looking at the use of private email by key Trump aides, including Jared Kushner. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. For Food Friday today, we're joined by one of the foodiest food people around, Christopher Kimball.
Milk Street is a hub for good food with a television show, cooking classes, and a radio show, which you can hear Sundays at 10 a.m. on Wisconsin Public Radio. Kimball is out to spread the word about new style home cooking that he says is simpler and smarter, yet still familiar.
Christopher Kimball joins us to talk about his new cookbook. It's called Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Your new cookbook is about what you call the new home cooking. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Sure, in 30 words or less. it simply means that there are lots of answers to the question, what's for dinner? And at Milk Street, we're traveling around the world to cook with people, not fancy restaurants, but at home, to rethink how to cook at home. You know, most of American cooking traditionally, you know, Fanny Farmer was Northern European, French, English, et cetera. But other people in the world have very different ideas about how to cook and how to combine ingredients. And we think you end up with big, bold flavors, and it's pretty easy to do. So that's the new home cooking.
And you start out your book with a really interesting concept, I think, that the realization that there's no such thing as ethnic cooking. Explain that for us.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of ethnic cooking. You know, back in the 50s and 60s when I was growing up, there was a lot of discussion about ethnic culture and foods. And so these were fancy recipes in general. Everyone was trying to be authentic. And you'd spend all day Saturday making them, right? and it was always our food kind of versus their food, you know? We didn't integrate the two. They were just separate worlds. So once a month you might cook a authentic Indian dish or Mexican dish or Sichuan dish. I think now it's changed. The music and fashion worlds have certainly changed the game now. So the concept is home cooks from around the world all sit at this really big table, and we're all doing the same thing. We're putting dinner on the table, and it's not our food versus their food. It's just food. If you live in Mexico City, do you cook mole sauce every night? No. You probably cook pasta. You know, you might cook Turkish food. You might cook a Sichuan dish. So it's not our food and their food. It's just food. And let's not worry about the fancy stuff. Let's just, let's just cook dinner on a Tuesday night and do it together. So that's what I meant by that.
And your book, it draws from recipes around the world and dishes from around the world. So when you got the whole world to pick from, how do you do it?
Well, I just got off a call with someone in Taiwan a few minutes ago, and we had exactly that discussion for 45 minutes. And the things you pick are the things that are simpler, the things that don't involve really hard-to-find ingredients, although we use a larger palette of ingredients than I did 5 years ago, and things that I call bridge recipes, things that, you know, would work here. You can take a Chinese scallion pancake, you know, and turn it into something that works here. You can take a beef noodle soup and turn it into something that works here. You can take a braised chicken dish from Taiwan that has a couple of interesting ingredients in it and make it work here. So those things work. Lots of other things don't because they're unique to a place. They're complicated. They're part of the culture, and they don't really travel.
You talked about ingredients, and let's dig into that. Let's go into the pantry. What do we need to stock in the pantry to be ready to cook?
Well, here is one of my revelations, which, you know, wasn't brilliant. It came to me late. But, you know, I've cooked out of Mastering Out of French Cooking since it came out almost. And I was thinking, like, well, how many spices were used in that book? You know, almost none. How many herbs? Four or five, you know, with the small amounts. How many chilies? None. How much ginger? None. You know, how much fermented sauce? So the world has at its disposal in different places all sorts of big flavors, right? So I would say there are four or five spices you should have. You don't have to go crazy. Cumin and coriander being sort of the two. Smoked paprika, maybe turmeric, maybe a different kind of pepper. but cumin certainly in the Middle East is the black pepper of the Middle East. They use salt and cumin, not salt and pepper. So half a dozen spices. A good soy sauce and a good fish sauce are really helpful. And having some dried chilies around, you know, which you can get at almost any supermarket these days, like a New Mexico chili, which isn't that spicy, is great. And then, you know, when you go shopping, buy, you know, some lots of herbs. We just did a recipe here that had 2 cups of cilantro, 2 cups of parsley, and 1 cup of dill. So just by upping the amount of herbs you use, you can completely change a recipe. For example, lots of places in the world when they do chicken soup, they'll throw in a couple handfuls of herbs at the end, handfuls. So it's not always a question of having something different. It's just using more of it.
Well, and speaking of herbs, you've got a recipe in here for a Persian omelet, which we used to have a place nearby that we loved. Both Judith and I were remembering how much we loved this cuckoo sabzi.
It's cuckoo, yes.
Let's say it together. Right,
well,
and you've got a recipe.
That's the recipe I just mentioned that has the dill and the parsley and the cilantro. You know, it has 6 eggs in it, a few spices. I think it has cardamom, cinnamon, and maybe cumin. And that's the thing that, you know, cinnamon, for example, is used throughout the Middle East, but it's used in savory cooking. You know, you always see the sweet, warm spice, allspice cinnamon, with a cumin or coriander. It's a nice, or in kofta, you know, essentially the meatballs of the Middle East, North Africa, like in Turkey, they often put cinnamon in that. So, it's not so much having this huge array of stuff in your pantry. It's just using it differently.
I have to say, I make a cinnamon chicken recipe that has tomatoes and onions and garlic and white wine and bay leaves. And when I first saw it, I was really skeptical because I do have the American conception of cinnamon. Yep. And I love it. It's one of my go-to recipes.
There's a Vietnamese beef noodle soup we did a few months ago, which has a lot of cinnamon sticks in it. And it's just unbelievably good. And that's, you know, if you think about French cooking or Northern European cooking, much of which is fabulous, but it has fairly mild ingredients, and a lot of technique and time and heat is applied to it to come up with a dish that is, you know, for the most part, a melting pot, right? I mean, a beef stew, everything tastes like beef. A chicken soup, everything tastes like chicken. Other places in the world have a totally different point of view. Their concept is when you taste something, they're sweet and sour or sweet and hot, and there's creamy and crunchy. There's bitter. You know, there's chard, there are other things we don't do much with here. And so there's a lot of stuff going on. And as you said, the cinnamon with savory is just an interesting, counterpoint to what we normally have. So what constitutes cooking in other places in the world is actually more complex. It's not harder. It's just that even on the fifth bite, you know, you have that heat going and that sweet going. For example, if you cook with chilies and you want to balance the dish, add sugar. Sugar will actually take the heat down and make it more flavorful. So those are just some of the things we're trying to get at here, is to figure out the theory of it, you know, what's going on in the recipe, not just the ingredients.
We're talking to Chris Kimball right now. He's the author of Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. And you were mentioning beef stews, Chris, and you've got a recipe for one of these. You say you can use beef or lamb, but the kicker is it's no-sear beef or lamb and chickpea stew. Can you tell us what's special about that one?
Yeah, there are two things I learned in that recipe. One is use water. If you simmer chicken or beef or lamb in water, you get stock, right? You don't need to start with stock. Stock was designed for a stove, coal stove, for example, that was on all day, and you put a big pot on the back burner, you know, where it's not that hot, and you just throw all your trimmings in all day, right? So it made a lot of sense. But if you do beef stew or beef soup with beef stock and sauté the meat, you get a umami bomb. You get the extra umami from the sautéing. You get the extra umami from the beef stock. In that recipe, which I love, I've made it a dozen times, you get a balance. There's herbs, there are spices, there's a pound of meat, I think, or a pound and a half, not too much, the chickpeas. You know, you get a lot of things going on. You don't let the meat overpower the dish. You know, America is all about protein, right? And so is Northern Europe because meat was cheap. There was a lot of meat, and there was a lot of fuel. And so we're meat-heavy. The rest of the world, meat, today, even today, is expensive, so they use it more sparingly, and I think you end up with a more interesting dish as a result.
There are so many great recipes in this book. One that really caught my attention is the brown butter cardamom banana bread.
Oh, yeah.
I love cardamom.
Same here.
And we should be cooking together more often, clearly, Veronica. And you do use cardamom quite a bit in the book. What do you like about it, Chris?
Well, one of the most interesting uses of cardamom is in the Middle East, like in Jerusalem or Palestine, where they brew coffee with it. They grind cardamom up with the coffee beans. And it's just amazing. I mean, cardamom has, I think, maybe other than saffron, has the most unusual flavor. And it could go savory and go sweet. And it's just an amazing flavor. And I don't like black cardamom too much. That's a very different taste, but the green cardamom pods or white pods, if they're blanched, it's just a wonderful flavor. You can just use it in almost anything. I mean, that's really so interesting. You know, if you just add that little bit of cinnamon or that cardamom or a little cumin, you completely transform a dish. And Americans, not all Americans, but I grew up really without spices, right? I mean, nutmeg, cinnamon, allspice, whatever, salt and pepper, which is a weird combination, salt and pepper. You know, we never cooked with cardamom or cumin or coriander or turmeric or paprika or other things. And so just doing that, just adding a few of those things. Most places in the world, especially in the Middle East, they have spice blends like za'atar. Or in Palestine, they'll make up their own blends. And those blends, the Japanese have blends. So almost every culture has a spice blend. And just having a couple of spice blends, you know, there's a joke in Boston, a chef who has a restaurant called Olean, a Turkish restaurant. She always told me, I said, what's the secret to your success? And she says, well, the T-shirt should be, it's the za'atar, stupid, you know, like the Clinton campaign back in the 90s. And she just said, she just puts za'atar on everything. You put it on eggs, you put it on chicken. And it's true. I have a tin of spices I keep on my kitchen counter. You know, in India they have these tins, and inside they're smaller tins holding spices. And I have some couple Japanese blends. I have za'atar and dukkha and then some chilies and salt. And just all you have to do is start using that, and your cooking is transformed. It's really not that hard.
And Chris, as we wrap up, now that the season is changing, what is your favorite thing to cook for the colder weather? What are you excited about?
Well, my wife is half Austrian. Her mother is from Salzburg, and we go almost every year. And I discovered a dish there. It's like pot au feu. It's called Tafelspitz. It's usually a beef roast or two beef roast shoulder, and it's essentially boiled meat, which I know nobody thinks is sounds good. But you simmer it for like 3 hours, take it out when it's tender, and then cook some vegetables in it. And then you can serve it with horseradish or salsa verde, whatever you want. It's the world's easiest recipe. The thing is, you know, we used to boil meat. Boiling was the first way to cook food, right, or one of the first ways after just over a fire. And the texture is wonderful, and it's clean. It just has a wonderful, subtle flavor. And so every time we want people over in the winter, you know, it's Tafelspitz time. You just get a couple, 3 or 4 pound roasts, cover them with water and simmer them for the afternoon, and then, you know, put fennel in, potatoes, carrots, whatever you want. You're done. I mean, it's easy, and it's really good, and it makes a fabulous lunch as well.
Well, you've got our mouths watering. Chris, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
My pleasure.
That was Christopher Kimball. His new book is called Milk Street, The New Home Cooking.